What's up, guys, and welcome to Script Blast, a podcast to help you write better screenplays and write a better life. I'm Avery Cochran, the producer of this podcast, and in this episode, Hudson has an awesome interview with writer, director, producer, and designer David Ocampo. A self-labeled story agnostic, David has never been one to be held back by the constraints of genre or medium, and dabbles in everything from graphic novels to film to video games, and his critically acclaimed audio drama, Wormwood. So if you're anything like David, and you find yourself unsatisfied with pigeonholing yourself in one medium, this interview is for you. Today we'll learn how to choose what medium is best for telling our stories, the key to finding collaborators while on a budget, and how, deceptively, the craziest fantasy worlds can help us tell the most relatable stories. Like the last episode, this was recorded late last year during the COVID-19 pandemic. If there's anything I've learned from David, it's that if something lights a fire in you, pursue it, even if that means dabbling in unfamiliar mediums. Find collaborators that are just as passionate as you, which is easier said than done, right? Well, if you're finding yourself hitting wall after creative wall online and you're looking to jumpstart your writing, we've got something for you. Script Blast Members is our brand new private community for writers just like you. Hop on into our weekly Writers Room group Zoom calls, free courses and resources, and the coolest community of writers out there. Finally, a screenwriting community that doesn't suck. Try it free for a week at members.scriptblast.com. Now here's Hudson and David.
All right, Dave, how's it going, man?
It's going all right. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So who knows what the world will be like when this actually comes out, but right now we're kind of coronaed off from each other.
Yeah, no kidding.
How's that world treating you? Is life completely different from you? Are you used to staying home? How does this affect your daily life?
Yeah, it's kind of funny that's exactly how I describe it to people, because I do work from home. And I work in front of a computer all day long, you know, whether it's writing or design work or any other kind of production that I do. And so my work flow hasn't really changed, but the rest of the world has changed around me. So that's how I like to think of it. As everyone else goes home and learns how to do Zoom meetings and juggle things like that, they're a little slower to respond to me. So our back and forth has changed a bit. And also, I like to write in cafes. I don't know. I don't think you and I have ever talked about this, but my thing is I like to write in cafes. I like to go somewhere outside of the four walls of my house, and I actually feed on the kind of the chaos and the energy of a setting like that. And so now I can't.
Interesting.
Do that. Yeah.
Well, let's jump into that for a second, and then we'll kind of go back to your story. But in terms of your writing environment, first of all, do you consider yourself introvert or extrovert?
Oh man, good question. I've done those tests before, like the Myers-Briggs test, and I think I come out as an extrovert, but I'm not the extrovert that like you go to the party and you come in and you're greeting everyone and you'll talk to anybody. I'm kind of the extrovert where I'll get into one long conversation with another person, like this, for example.
Okay. You know? Yeah.
You know what I mean? I feed off the energy of talking to somebody. So I do process a lot externally, which makes me like a big collaborative creator and stuff like that. But at the same time, being a writer, you kind of do still have to go up and go and hole up and everything, you know? So I it's kind of a weird mix, I guess.
Well, that's how I've kind of heard it described, is really, where do you get your energy? And so you were talking about, oh, I need to be out in cafes. I need to be like around people in order to get that energy. And so it sounds like it's part of that.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're in a cafe. Do you listen to music when you write?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes. It has to be kind of instrumental. I love jazz, like old jazz, like Miles Davis, Coltrane, Monk, Mingus. The other things I'll do is I'll pick scores or soundtracks or anything kind of mood. There's certain things I like, Nine Inch Nails, like the Ghosts 1-4 album I used for a long time. Sigur Rós I used for a while. What other kind of ambient sounds and things like that, really moody scores. If it has a certain vibe to it, if I'm trying to write like an action scene, I might try to find something that's a little more you know, jumped up, you know, or if I want to create like an atmosphere of, you know, mystery or dread or horror, you know, I try to find soundtracks and things like that that will match that.
Tell me what all you write. So I know you do a lot of comic stuff. I know you've done some audio drama stuff before. You also do some filmmaking stuff as well.
Yeah, well, it's been sort of like it's sort of an evolution. So maybe I can take you through kind of how it all got started, because I've done all of that, but it's sort of been on this long and windy path, right?
Yeah. Well, let's back up. Okay. Let's start at the beginning. So did you grew up, I'm assuming, reading comics, enjoying film. I'm assuming writing. What was it like, your kind of childhood like?
The very first novel I remember finishing was The Hobbit in the third grade. And then that, I think that had to have led to like this just huge a fascination with fantasy. And so like kind of my earliest childhood was sort of reading stuff like the Chronicles of Narnia or the Lord of the Rings books, or what was the other one? Lloyd Alexander, the Black Cauldron and the High King and all those. And I would write my own fantasy stories. In fact, in the fourth grade, I had a teacher. Her name was Mrs. Tudsbury. I'll never forget her, because she allowed us to write, the whole class had an assignment to write a story about a dragon. And it was like, it felt like this was the moment I had been waiting for. And so I did this, you know, it really like just aping all the stuff I had been reading, Lloyd Alexander and Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, and, you know, probably churned out some very predictable, you know, just copies of them. But that's how you start, right?
Sure.
But she took it the next step, because and I didn't really think about this until I was an adult, when I realized that this was in the 80s and there weren't any real like word processing or rather easy to access layout programs. So she must have gone home and taken this class of 30 kids and their short stories and typeset each of them, because she brought it back in not just with a typed manuscript, but a typed manuscript that had these photostated like dragon drawings into them that had come from like a book that she had shared with us. It was like a history of medieval dragons. So suddenly I had like this Tolkien-esque manuscript with illustration in it. And then we made our own covers where we tie-dyed them, like taking this paper. I can't remember what kind of paper it was, but we like folded it and dipped it into paint. And then you unfold it and it's like a tie-dye pattern. And then we glued it onto the cardboard and put these rings together. So I actually, in the fourth grade, made my first book.
you were self-published well ahead of the crowd there,
right? So I mean, that for me was like sort of the, I think, falling in love with writing and you know, falling in love with fantasy and literature at that point. And then I think at the same time, you know, as I describe it, you know, like I'm old enough to remember the first Star Wars movies, and those were probably amazing for that fantasy in the same way that the books gave me one thing, this gave me the visual spectacle. But those movies were kind of few and far between, or they'd be really cheesy versions when they had like the knockoffs and stuff, or tried to do it on television or whatever. And so my staple was comic books. You know, they were in all the spinner racks. I could go in for like 50 cents, 75 cents, a dollar. I could go and I could look through and I could find the one that had the coolest art, the best fight scenes. Yeah. And just, I just totally fell in love with that art form. I didn't know it. I didn't think of it as an art form. I just fell in love with comic books and superheroes, you know, right from that moment.
Yeah. And did you start making your own comics at that point?
I did. So I remember, I had always had sketchbooks that had drawings in them. Like I remember trying to draw, like I had this Blue Ribbon Digest of some old Flash stories, like Silver Age Flash stories. And they had like Carmen Infantino art. And there was this way that he drew the Flash where he looked like he was like vibrating. And I remember I had these like sketchbooks filled with like these drawing the Flash, which is really just me taking colored pencils and making a bunch of like red and yellow streaks and things like that.
Yeah.
And then I remember seeing two friends, they were like family friends, and these two boys, brothers, had made their own comics. And I was like, oh my God, I want to do that. And I kind of copied their style and made these very simple, like breaking a sheet of 8.5 by 11 paper into like three or four just tiers, like just a line across it. And then making, so almost like a storyboard, right?
Yeah.
Those were my first comics. And then it wasn't until, is it okay if I go in deep here? This is going to go deep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let me ask a question about that real quick though. So what was it about that art form that pulled you into it? Like, what was special about that? And this is a question, my story is insanely similar to yours, that I had a teacher that believed in me, and the one class that I got to be up in front of the class was the, you know, she gave me a one page assignment. I'd write 20 pages. Then I discovered comics, very similar, started making my own comics.
Yeah.
but I've never asked myself that question of why, like what was so appealing about that? So I'm kind of curious to get in your brain a little bit, your high school, middle school brain of what was it that was so uplifting about creating these things?
That's a really good question, because like you, I'm not sure I've ever really answered it in that or that directly or thought about it that deeply. But I would say that I think it was probably a confluence of things, that I grew up at a time when, you know, you could read fantasy literature, you could see some visual spectacle on the screen, but it didn't always look that great. And then in comics, you had this very expressive version of that. Art could be, there was a comic that I read that I loved. It's the first one I remember really loving. It was called The Micronauts. And I'm really dating myself by talking about this, but, but it was based on a toy line. But this is before G.I. Joe and the Transformers really hit. It was a Japanese toy line, and then Marvel Comics made a comic out of it. And it was a space opera. There was a man in black armor, very much of a Darth Vader type. And so I'm reading this, and I'm probably reading it because of the Star Wars connection, you know, because it felt it was a space opera. But in that, I was seeing centaurs and winged people and insectoid, humanoid people, and something about the comic art and the way that the story was being told. And I think also, you know, I mentioned earlier that I could look through the comics and see what had the best fight scenes. That's how I actually used to pick out comics, is I would flip through them and decide what had the best fight scene. So I think there's something growing up in the 70s, 80s, you know, martial arts, Bruce Lee movies, ninja movies, Chuck Norris movies, that like martial arts were a big part of it too. And so seeing that sort of slowed down to a choreographed comic book pace, like cool, this wonderful action frozen in time, was maybe something really interesting to me. I don't know. I've never really thought about it, but I just knew that then when it came to seeing that I could maybe draw my own comics, it was something better than writing my own stories in a way. I mean, not better, just different, but there was a way that I could get to that visceral part of it, that visual, that illustrative part that captured my imagination in movies and comic books, that I actually could do that with a pencil and paper and tell a story that way. And so I think, I think that's gotta be it.
So would you say that you're always a very visual storyteller? Like you think in pictures?
Very much so. Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, pick us back up in the story. We're what, in high school at this point?
Yeah.
You're making your own comics and stuff? Okay,
I was, you know, I hadn't made comics for years, and then, again, I'm going to totally date myself, because if I go into this in detail, you'll laugh. So, you know, I'm now a teenager, 16 or something like that. I've got friends. We're goofing off all the time. And this guy who couldn't really draw us, we started trading these little comic strips back and forth. And it was Fat Man and Blubber Boy, as I remember the first strip. And obviously a ripoff, but it was like just a way of kind of, it was just a vehicle to tell like sort of our jokes. But then he would do these like two or three panel strips, and then I would respond with them. But then you could tell that I was waiting for this moment, kind of like, you know, kind of like I said before, like realizing I could write and draw my own comics, is I was waiting for an excuse to do something bigger. So then like I would come back with a 5-page story that was, you know, refuting his story. The Saturday Night Live characters of Hans and Franz, the bodybuilders, were big at the time. I introduced Hans and Franz to fight Fat Man and Blubber Boy. And so it was like this it was like this dueling battle of comics. And then as that sort of petered out, I still had this energy, like I wanted to do more. And so I started five pages or something like that, of a story called Psycho Ninja, which was literally about a young man who is in an insane asylum. And he thinks he's a ninja, and he ends up breaking out and going and fighting all normal people, but he sees them as ninjas, and would constantly do that back and forth viewpoint. But then, and it was kind of meant as a joke, but then as people liked it, and I would literally draw this on 8.5 by 11 paper in pencil, and then pass pages around in my classes to friends.
Yeah. And then, that's amazing. I'd read that now.
They wanted more, right? So, and at this point, I think I was reading stuff like, Frank Miller, like Frank Miller's Elektra Assassin or Ronin, if you remember that graphic novel he did.
Gotcha.
And so I was aping a lot of that. But what happened was the jokey part of it fell away and it became this more serious thing as I kept going. And I was pulling from those sources, Denny O'Neill on The Question and doing stuff like that. And I started to peel away the jokes and say, oh, no, he actually has been possessed by a ninja spirit. And it's all part of this plot to bring down America. It was all Japanese corporate takeover. And at the time, the vice president was Dan Quayle. And I had this like joke written in, or not even a joke. It was serious that like if he could assassinate the president, then we would all be destroyed because the vice president was so dumb, you know, or something like that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it ended up being 80 pages long. And I never finished it. But like I knew I was in like, I didn't know the terminology, but I was entering the third act. He was going to this like tower where the Japanese businessman who was really evil was residing, and he had brought together the two sides of his soul, merged the ninja and the normal guy in him, and he was ready to take down like the big boss. And then I think I graduated from high school and and never finished it. but that was really an extended, I mean, 80 pages of writing and drawing a comic book that got passed around to students. And in fact, some of the people I graduated with, they held on to it for a couple of years, and I came back and got it at one point because it was like in this little manila envelope and just like it, and it was lovingly cherished and passed around amongst my friends.
That's so awesome. So you had this, I mean, that's it takes a massive amount of passion in order to create something like that, right?
I guess so. I didn't think of it that way. I had to do it, you know, and I think I was feeding off of the serialization of, you know, giving out pages to everybody and then seeing their reaction and then being able to say things like, oh, and what was your favorite part? You know, like, shamelessly like asking, what part did you like the best? You know, like, I think that fueled this. And I think it was, I didn't care that like my drawing wasn't good or bad, you know, at that point. I was just able to do it and people liked it. I would feel insecure when I went to an actual art class and saw some of the other like people that were actually talented painters, because I was kind of drawing comic book figures and they weren't terrible, but they also weren't really good and the anatomy wasn't right or anything. But I was copying what I was seeing. So it was, you know, that sort of copy of a copy of a copy without the knowledge behind it of anatomy or, you know, a perspective and things like that. So
did you stick with art? Because I just know you as a writer. Do you do art stuff as well?
No. See, that's the next part of the story, right? Is that I think that as I left high school, I think that secretly I had this dream, and I've never talked about this until recently, but I think I really, if I could have dreamt big and done anything, what I really wanted to do was go to like the Joe Kubert school, you know, of cartoon. Like I wanted to, but I didn't think I was good enough of an artist. And so I went to college and my first major was criminal justice, actually. But I took an art class in that. And then, I'm sorry, it wasn't an art class in criminal justice. I took an art class while attending, you know, while being a freshman at Sacramento State University in California. And I quickly realized that I didn't think I was that good at drawing, but B, I also was really struggling in school and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so from there, I sort of bounced around. I left that school. I bounced around to a couple community colleges and I took some like figure drawing classes. And I kind of was pretty good at certain bits, but then, you know, I would get that same compliment of like, it's kind of like to make a comic book reference, it's kind of like the Rob Liefeld effect. I wasn't good at drawing like hands and feet. I did like a live, like a nude model drawing class, and I would leave off the hands and feet because I just didn't know how to deal with them. But some of my rendering was good.
You can apparently be very successful and still not
hands and feet. So, I just draw big like smoke clouds around their ankles and no. But what happened in that time period is I was kind of finding myself, I would say. So this is like, you know, somewhere between like 18 and like 22. I ended up in a creative writing class with a poet named Susan Brown, who just like really made me fall in love with writing. So I kind of, at that point, that's where I said, you know what, I'm not going to be the artist. That's not going to work for me. I absolutely love writing like this. And she was one of those people that didn't really talk a lot about structure and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. It was more about breaking free that frozen sea within you. I think that's part of I'm probably butchering it, but it's like a Kafka quote or something. Somebody said it. And I remember her saying that in one of the classes, like using the axe to break the ice, and it was all about expression. It was all about expressing yourself, maybe killing off the cliche language, getting in deeper, but really expressing yourself. And so I started writing short stories and poetry. But really, I think as I continued on that, and I ended up graduating from San Francisco State with a English degree with an emphasis in creative writing. And there, wow. a lot of that was me kind of taking what I was doing, which was a lot of very literary fiction, and then also realizing, and at this time, books like The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay were coming out by Michael Chabon. Uh-huh. So literary fiction was kind of moving into using a few of the genre tropes. And I felt I could see something was happening. And I got really excited that, you know, like I could bring some like pulpy influences into literary fiction, which I think now we have much more of a mix. But at the time, and this is around like 98, it took me a while to get through school.
and comics looked pretty different then. I think maybe early 2000s, we started to see a little more kind of deeper storytelling, and the emphasis went towards writing again, where in the 90s it was much more artist focused.
Well, yes and no. So the one thing I'll correct you there is that Vertigo came about in the early 90s. And so people like Neil Gaiman were writing Sandman from the late 80s through the 90s. And so for me, I forgot that part of the story, is that I was reading that stuff and that stuff was lighting me up. But I would go to my literary classes and it was all kind of that semi-biographical memoir kind of writing that a lot of people were doing that was very popular at that time. And so I felt like these two halves were like just separated from each other. But there was a deeper bit of writing on the Vertigo side. There was also Image, which was all about the as you might imagine, the Image, right? So you had Image comics that were all, splashy and in your face. And but the writing was really bad and I couldn't read those. And so I kind of like my comics hole became this like small little corner of like indie and like Vertigo-esque material from that time period. And so there was good writing and deeper writing going on at that time. I was looking for a way to merge those two halves that I was seeing.
Right. Yeah. I'm curious, talking about kind of your poetry class and talking about, that idea of self-expression and really putting yourself out there. Is that something that has kind of influenced your writing from that point on? And no matter what you're doing, whether it's, you know, seemingly surface level kind of comic stuff, is all of that kind of very personal to you and kind of influenced by that?
Yeah, definitely. It was definitely, at the time, it was what I needed to get going and to really think about and to kind of think about voice and think about passion, as you said, you know, and think about like, you know, really getting true emotions. And I was seeing that in stuff like Neil Gaiman's writing and doing it in Sandman. I felt like there was real truth in those. And that's where I became like a real fan of his. Or even like Grant Morrison, some of his early stuff had a lot of that in it too, but also mm-hmm. had these like pulpy elements in it and these weird sci-fi elements. And so that was really cool. But yeah, I think I needed that first. I needed to kind of know that personal side of writing that didn't really bother with structure, because that's like the next phase of the story is me moving to LA and then slowly getting into the screenwriting side of things. And then it became more about structure and I think it worked for me because I had this background of, you know, self-expression and being true and saying something with your writing. And sometimes I don't even today, I don't see it necessarily until after I've written. But it is important to me to look and see, you know, okay, I'm not just telling a story about a werewolf. I'm telling a story about, you know, somebody who has predatory habits that doesn't like them, but feels consumed by them. And so how does one live their life knowing that the next full moon is coming, you know? And so that's something that maybe I can relate to, because maybe I have bad habits or anger inside of me or whatever it is, the emotions that we can all relate to. And I know what I'm trying to get out when I tell a story about a werewolf.
Yeah. So that brings up, I attended a class that you were teaching recently about comic book writing. And one of the things you said that helps you with pitching, but also just helps you with idea generation is what is the idea behind the idea, right? So you've got a surface level idea, like you had mentioned, a werewolf. What's the idea behind that? What is it that makes it deeper? What is it that makes it something that people can grab onto and connect to? And I found that to be such an important tip that a lot of people miss, right? So they're like, oh, I love werewolves. I'm going to write a werewolf story. And they go out and it comes out. And it's just kind of real surface level, or it's real kind of just paying homage to other stuff that's out there. But really finding that thing beneath the thing. And I think a lot of that is tied to what can you relate to in that story, right? So, because if you're not passionate about it, if you're not bringing something to it, if you're not bringing that emotional openness to it, that it's going to come off flat.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, as an example, I remember somebody saying this to me years ago when I was in college, and that always stuck with me is that they said something like, any movie about an alien invasion is really about humans. And that sounds very simple, right? But thinking about it that way, like, who is the invader? We're they're always like a human being in a way, right? Like if it either is like this locust like force, or if it's going to be something a little more savvy, there's somebody that wants something. And so we're looking at a piece of humanity. We're looking at a reflection of ourselves. It's the same thing with fantasy, right? Like, you know, you can tell a story about good and evil by using like hobbits and elves and wizards and things like that. But what you're really doing is talking about, you know, about humanity, about, you know, what it takes, what bravery gets you, what friendship gets you. And, you know, even Star Wars was about that, right? Like I think I understood it as a kid, and I didn't, on a level that I couldn't really express, but that, you know, there's that scene in the end of Return of the Jedi where, you know, he says, you know, what does Luke say? Something like now I'm going to forget it. I'm going to blow it that I'm on the spot. but he says something like, your arrogance will be your undoing. And the Emperor says, your faith in your friends is yours, you know? Idea being that, you know, here is the bad man who is thinking about himself, who's selfish, who's arrogant, and thinks he's got it all. He's got all the bases covered because he has all the power. But what he doesn't recognize is that, you know, friends and people working together can overcome a lot. And that's a survivor's story. That's a redemption story. That's a champ. You know, that's a story that resonates with all of us, is like, you know, overcoming these odds. And so I think any story like that, it's never about that thing. And I think, and you probably can relate to this a bit too, is that, you know, as you get to Hollywood, you see a lot of people, or to LA or to any screenwriting group, you know, you see a lot of people that have they put a lot of time into the high concept, like the high concept, you know, you know, it's like Jurassic Park meets Black Swan. It's dinosaurs and ballerinas. And it's, you know, and they're really getting into like, I have to come up with the concept that nobody, like the two things that nobody's ever put together before. But the thing is, what is the connective tissue and what makes it work? And it's usually not a plot thing. Usually it's what is underneath those metaphors, you know, what's underneath the metaphor of why you're bringing dinosaurs into it or ballerinas into it or whatever, you know. Not that that's a good example. I just, two things at random popped in my mind. I'd like to see someone come up with a pitch for that.
So let's, when an idea first goes into your head, do you start with plot in general? Like, do you have kind of a plot thing and then you go back and you apply that stuff to it? Or where do ideas generate for you?
Man, that is a good question. I want to say, I want to say that it can be plot, but it's not usually plot. It's usually some kind of contradiction or either something that I'm wrestling with. So it's usually, it can be an image. I think some of the earliest ones were the image. In that class that you mentioned, I described a book that I wrote called a comic that I wrote with Chris Anderson as my artist called Lost Angels. And the premise came about, you know, I've revealed this, so I'm going to say it here again on the podcast, is that, you know, earliest generation of it was me thinking about, you know, I always really loved like Hawkman and Hawk World and all that kind of stuff from DC Comics. I may never have a chance to, but what would I do if I could do my spin on it? And the idea that struck me was, you know, what if a piece of this alien world, a city from this alien world, crash landed on Earth? And I think what resonated with me there was that, like, how could how could you have a ghetto of refugees who could fly, but were confined to a small space. And what would that do to you? Like a small vertical space. And so once I started developing that out, I got rid of the connections to the DC thing. I made it these alien angels, just aliens with wings. And then that allowed me to kind of push into another territory too, which is, where do we get the idea of angels, of winged humans? Could it come from an alien race that we met once upon a time? So that gave me a little fun things to play with. But the initial concept was, and this is the first few pages of the graphic novel and the first few pages I scripted, but it was, a young man flying in the sky with wings and sort of gloriously swooping down, and he's happy as can be. And then he swoops in the next panel and you see the Hollywood sign behind him. So you're like, whoa, wait a minute. We're not in some alien planet, like Flash Gordon-y planet. We're in Hollywood. And then there's like a police helicopter behind him that's saying like, this is a restricted area. You're not allowed to fly here, And I love that idea. I love that image and the contradiction of here's a winged guy, but it's Hollywood. And now we don't know where we are. Now we've got to start expanding the world out from there. And so the whole thing kind of built from that. So that's not so much a plot as like a situation.
Which also goes back to showing how you think visually. So that's much, you're thinking in panels, you're thinking in pictures, and you're thinking in how are those contradictory and how are they ironic? And I find that fascinating because I feel like my brain works in very different ways. I'm not a very
really?
thinker. As a writer, I think I'm driven by theme and by characters and by interaction and by decision-making.
Yeah,
and I think that's a fault in my comic writing is that I don't think visually. I heavily rely on an artist to do the heavy lifting and like, hey, make something cool,
Right. Yeah, I think that definitely helps that I can sort of, without giving Chris the artist too many restrictions, I can say, here's what I see, and I don't call out the shots for him like it's this angle or that angle. I just kind of say, there's a man in the sky or there's a boy in the sky with wings. He's having a great time. Next panel. He's in front of the Hollywood sign. Next panel, there's a police helicopter behind him, and just kind of say it like that and then write the dialogue. But you're right. I guess I do in that case really think visually and think of an image. That said, I think there are other times where the theme hits me first, where I might be like, this is bothering me either in my personal life or looking out at the world. Here's a political situation that bothers me or something like that. And then kind of be like, and then kind of think about, what's a story? Or I start with an emotion. What am I really afraid of right now? Well, I'm afraid that, my cholesterol is too high and, I'm afraid that I'm going to die, and then I end up, I'll write a story about, okay, the guy does die and now he's a ghost. And at first he's super excited because he doesn't have the pain anymore. He doesn't have anything to worry about anymore, And then where does that go? So you're right. I'm not thinking, it's not necessarily like, I don't know where that's going to end, but I know what kicked it off for me and I know what I want to explore. So that to me, that's often the best part is kind of the beginning and sort of like working outward and seeing what the story is.
Yeah, our Mark Duplass, the writer and producer and actor, has this line where he says, when you're like hanging out with your friends and it's like 2 a.m. and you're a little drunk and you're just super comfortable and you're having those like deep, scary conversations about what keeps you up at night.
Yes.
He's like, that's the thing you should write a movie about. That's the thing you should be, the story you should be telling. Because it's that rare personal thing that everybody's going to connect to if you're brave enough to put it out.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's always these things that are, it's these details, the things that you're really afraid of that are actually universal, that whole idea of, universality but finding it through the details. And it's amazing when it seems like that story happens over and over again, when people let go and they really go after the element that scares them the most or that feels the most unique to them, they end up finding that a lot of people feel that way or that it is universal. And I think one trick, and I don't know if this is good or bad, but when I do turn around and make it a werewolf story, then it allows me, it kind of makes it a little more universal in that I know what I'm talking about, but everyone can look at that lens and they can look at that werewolf and they can see something, they can relate it to them. Like, oh my God, this reminds me of my addiction to alcohol, my, or whatever it is. There's a way that I think that by taking it into the fantastic, whether it's sci-fi or fantasy or whatever, and this is where I love using genre, is it kind of gives me a little freedom. I don't feel like I have to tell a biographical story. And so in a way, I almost am being more honest by throwing in vampires or werewolves or aliens, because I'm kind of like allowing myself to really get into the note behind the note, the fear behind the fear, right? Fear behind the idea, and then like blow it up into something else. And I don't know. I've not really ever said that quite out loud in an interview before or in a conversation before. So this is kind of new for me to realize.
Yeah, I love that. And that brings up another question. It's a very specific question that's always been in my mind of these two ideas. And you're one of the only people that I can actually talk to about it. So Scott McCloud talks about in Understanding Comics about the simplicity of drawings means that everybody can relate to it, right? So a smiley face, you can apply that to yourself.
Yeah.
The more detailed a drawing gets, the less you can relate because it becomes very specific and different from you.
Yeah.
But I've always had the thought as a writer that the more specific we get, say with a problem or an issue or with what you're personally going through, it is actually the opposite, that more people can relate to it. So I'm curious, and the broader you get where it's just kind of in the ether, you can't really relate because it's not a specific, you can't grab onto it, right? So I'm curious your thoughts on that, because you're in both the film writing world and the comic book world, and you're familiar with Scott McCloud and all that. I'm very curious your thoughts on the specificity of characters.
That's really interesting. I've not, you know, it almost seems like a contradiction, right? Like, because you're right. Like the more specific the art is, the less universal it is. Maybe that's why I like it, because it allows me to write with specificity, but then the nature of the art generalizes it a bit and makes it more universal. I'm just toying with this. I don't really know, but me being able to like write the idea and then hand it off to Chris, who actually has to illustrate these characters. The job is all his to kind of cartoon to, you know, the level that he can and what he can do and how he sees it. It allows me to focus on really, I don't know, maybe it allows me to be more specific because he's kind of doing this other part. And so therefore, like when you combine the two elements, you get something that is rich and detailed, but also very accessible. I mean, that's all I can think about. You've given me a whole new way to think about comics, which I hadn't really thought about before.
But that's interesting in its own way, because you see a picture in your mind, you translate it to words, your artist translates it into pictures, and then the reader translates those pictures and words into their own idea in their own brain, right? Yeah. That it is an interesting passing of the baton. With filmmaking, it's even more so, because I write something and then a director interprets it and then actors interpret it and the audience interprets it. It's a fun relationship, and I get real excited by storytelling in that way. Yeah. You know, for books and short stories, it's totally up to the audience. They can picture it however they want.
Exactly. It's completely internal. It's in their minds, you know, in their mind's eye. And yeah, you're right. Like, isn't that the thing that they say in film? It's like, there's the movie that you write. There's the movie that you shoot. There's the movie that you edit, you know, like and each one is different from that original image that the writer has. And what it does for us when we're writing in a collaborative medium like comics or film or TV or any other media, visual media, is that we're not as precious about it. We can't be. Right. Like the vision I have in my head of that kid flying in the sky is going to be different when it gets through Chris's pencils. But I like that. Like it allows me to like put my ego in the back seat and be like, and be surprised and delighted by what I get back. And it's not just me now. It is me and Chris together. And, you know, he's adding to it. And I think that's kind of been my similar experience. I haven't done a lot in film. And I'm gonna go a little bit back to my timeline just so you kind of know how I evolved out of that. I went to LA and I was not a screenwriter at all, but I ended up working a graveyard shift at a .com company in like 98, 99. And I met Jeremy Rogers, who was also working the graveyard shift with me. And we had lots of spare time at night and we started writing together. And so we wrote a couple of screenplays, and this was me kind of, like I said to you before, I was coming at it from this creative writing standpoint. He had gone to film school and was coming at it, and he knew structure more. And so I had a collaborator that I could kind of leave the structuring and the formatting of stuff. I didn't have to do all the heavy lifting. I didn't have to figure it all out. Like I was even struggling to understand what it really meant when you talked about first act, second act, third act, inciting incident. Like these things are like foreign to me from my gushy, mushy, you know, creative writing classes. Yeah. And so I was kind of learning all that, but collaborating back and forth and writing screenplays. But then from there, we decided at a certain point where we kind of didn't get a lot of traction. We had a few nibbles here and there, as you do, but nothing really came of it. And we decided to make our own short films. And that's when we formed our production company. And
oh, cool.
Yeah. So we made 3 short films. And that's where we started working with actors. And so then I, you know, similarly to the story I'm telling you with Chris as my artist, I'm working with actors and I'm seeing their interpretation of my work, or a cinematographer or DP that we hired for our movies, who I'm still friends with today, you know, like coming in with all these ideas of how to visually represent stuff that we hadn't even considered or that I hadn't considered, and just letting myself be sort of delighted by this whole process. You know, and then that lent itself into the audio drama, which came about because, and this is how I tell that story, is that I'm waiting for the sets to be lit on my third short film. And as you know, with a small crew, that can take hours for like, right. And then you yell action and the woman runs down the hallway, you yell cut, and now they got to do it all over again for the next scene. Right. And so that time I had one of the early iPods and I was listening to, or maybe it was like an iPod Nano or something like that, but I started listening to podcasts, and a podcast that you and I both know, iFanboy, was one about comic books. And so I start listening to the iFanboy, and I'm sitting here listening to these guys talk about comics while I'm bored. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'd almost rather do a podcast than any more movies, because this takes so long. and I thought, you know, actually the podcast itself, it's kind of like a global distribution platform through Apple. You could reach everybody. You don't have to, like as a short film, you're going to put it into a film festival. You're going to win an award. You're going to use that reputation to get something else going. It's a lot of work, right? And I thought, all we have to do is get rid of the picture. I can still use actors. And I started going back and listening to old audio dramas, radio dramas, you know, and going like, we could do this. And I wanted to do like a modern version of that. And so, you know, I think in 2007, we launched Wormwood, a serialized mystery, which was my way of working with actors in LA that many of whom I had worked with in the short films. But we also did a casting call and brought people in. And we got to we got to create our own writer's room. And we put together, I don't know, at the most we had maybe like 6 people in the writer's room, and we would have story sessions where we would break story the way I imagined a writer's room would be. I've never been in a writer's room. It was my idealized version of the writer's room. And so I would sit there and we'd be like, okay, let's figure out how to tell the story without pictures. So all voice, all dialogue, but we're going to have actors. We have access to these actors and they're going to do some amazing stuff. So let's figure it out. And then that lasted for like 3 seasons. We ran from like 2007 to 2011, and it's still on iTunes.
I remember listening to it, because I think this was about the time we met, just on the iFanboy forums, I believe, where we first connected. And they were phenomenal. I mean, they were very high production, full on, you know, sound effects and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you guys were so well ahead of your time doing that at that point now, right? Because there's now so many people are trying that out.
Yeah, that's the way I say it now. Is I say 2 things. I say we were like kind of, I think of us as like the garage band of audio drama podcasts, because I think I appreciate you saying that it was well produced, but we got dings here and there on the audio quality. And I think you can hear, you can hear some of it in there where we didn't really know what we were doing. And we used kind of some bad special effects here and there and some of the mics, like you know, there's just some bad audio in places, but you know what? I think if you're really into it, you know, you can see the passion in it all, and you don't really get I love it warts and all, is basically what I'm saying.
But
the way I say it to people is, I'm like, if you think of the curve as being where people can monetize, then we were well ahead of the curve, because we did 3 seasons. We never made any money on it at all. But I still have people to this day discovering the podcast and sending me notes. In fact, one of my most recent graphic novels, The Margins, was drawn by Amanda Donahue, who I found because she posted a note on the Wormwood website saying, you know, I found your show. I really love it. I've been doodling your characters. while I've been in a, and it's really taken me out of the artistic funk. And I said, these are really good, actually. There's some good storytelling. Have you ever thought about doing comics? And she was working in, she works in animation. And cool. She's like, I never thought about that before. And I'm like, well, I have a project.
Wow.
And it, you know, worked out. And so again, Wormwood is this like linchpin that connects me to like so many different things. And almost all of my comics material, you know, spins out of what we did by creating Wormwood. Cool. Yeah.
So let's talk about that real quick, because I really want to get into some of, you know, the medium of comics and how people, writers who especially are wanting to stretch some of those muscles because they're frustrated with a, you know, stagnant screenwriting career, how they might could shift and actually get some stuff produced and see their stories actually being told. And you can kind of add your own stories to that too, so we can get through the rest of your history. But first of all, what is it that makes comics different than other mediums? Because you've jumped around a whole bunch from kind of prose to filmmaking to audio dramas. What is it that makes comics unique?
Yeah, well, and that's how I started the class that I ran just recently, because I thought it was really important to say, okay, why comics? Like things to think about before you approach the medium of comics, which is, you know, you can tell your story about dinosaurs and ballerinas in any medium, right? But it takes a very different shape if you write it as a novel. As you said, like, you know, the audience is going to imagine things. You're going to, it lends itself much better to like an internal narrative voice, right? Whether it's third person or first person or multiple perspectives, you know, a novel can really capture that well. And then in film, obviously you're working much more visually. But at the same time, comics are sort of some people think of them as like this. I think I used to think of it as a hybrid between the two, between like writing a novel and creating a movie, in that you could do the widescreen visual storytelling, very dynamic action, but then you could put really wonderful prose in narrative captions over those images and create something entirely new that was both, you know, like imagine if you could put captions over the painting of the Mona Lisa, or, you know, or something like that. Like it changes everything. It's a different way of telling a story. It's and you, the audience interprets it differently, because they can look at the art, they can read the caption, then they put them together and they decide, and then you put another picture next to it, and then they now, you know, now they're moving through it and they're reading it, you know, in sequence. Yeah.
If you just have an idea pop into your head, how do you know what it wants to be? How do you know if it wants to be a comic or a movie or a novel, or especially for someone who's maybe still figuring out where they fit?
That's a really good question. I kind of feel like it's whatever you want it to be, like you, but just know that that's the shape it's, that it, the medium is going to affect the shape of the story, at least in my mind. Like I came up with this idea a while back, and Chris was, so the other thing is, do you have an artist that's willing to draw this for you? Or can you afford to pay an artist to draw it for you?
Right.
Because that's the thing in comics. So if you're writing a screenplay, you know, you have outlets ideally where you can sell it, or places where you can take it. But you're writing a thing that is not complete on its own, but you have multiple avenues. You have an industry built around buying those things. With comics, it's a little bit different, because it's not, it's rare at this point in the industry that you as a new writer, new to comics, would be able to write a script, give it to a publisher and say, find an artist to draw this and publish it. And you get, you know, any traction with that at all. If you are a big filmmaker, you probably can do that. If you're a big novelist, you can probably do that. Because, you know, once you have a name, you can break down a lot of those walls. But let's assume you're not.
Yeah, it's kind of like any industry right now, right? It's moving towards the kind of self-publishing. I mean, novelists are self-publishing. Filmmakers are making indie films on minuscule budgets.
Yeah,
musicians are self-releasing on YouTube. And comic books are no different.
Yeah, exactly. So the tricky part about comic books and deciding if this is a good comic book property is, do you have someone to draw it? Whether that's paying them or just being really good friends with them and they like your ideas, or they want to be in on it with you, so that it's now creator owned, you guys own it together, and you've decided that you're going to produce it together, then you can start to see how that story is going to take shape as a comic book. I don't think you can get very far without, in this day and age, I mean, certainly you can do it, but realistically, I would not put too much effort into making it a comic book unless you kind of have an idea of that somebody's going to be able to draw this for you. And that sounds colder than I mean it to. But what I mean is, like, I mean, I would maybe write the pitch for it, right? You know, maybe even outline the plot for it. But you know, it really doesn't come alive until you've got somebody to put it together. So like Chris and I did a pitch recently and, you know, I wrote the pitch and I slaved over the pitch. He did character designs and then we came together and wrote and I did a 6-page script, the first 6 pages of the script, and then he drew them and then I lettered them and we put it together in a package. And this puts us in a better position with certain publishers because we have an entire package put together. It's not the whole story. It's like a sizzle reel, you know, it's a comic book sizzle reel. It's the equivalent of that. But it also tells them, hey, I've got a team already put together and they're both willing to work together on this. And that gives us a lot more. We can go a lot farther with that.
So talk about that real quick about how you find artists, because I have about a half dozen false starts on comic book projects where I would connect with an artist. They would be amazing. And then I couldn't afford to pay them and somebody else could. So they'd have to leave and take the paid project. And then I'm kind of stuck with this 5-page preview I can't do anything with because they're no longer available. Right. So at some point I started to be like, wow, I'm really good at finding talent because they keep going on and being in these awesome projects that don't include me. But talk a bit about how do you find your artists? How do you build those relationships? How do you connect with people?
Yeah. And sadly I'm in a similar place to you where, you know, that happens. That's a real thing that happens. I have a few scripts sitting in a drawer that like, oh, I was going to do that with this guy, but then he disappeared on me. And I think you'll find that the comics landscape is littered with stories like that. It's littered with undrawn scripts, right? Or five pages drawn before the person moved on to something else. Very fortunate in that Chris is a very good friend of mine. And, you know, I think we kind of were coming in together at it. And it was sort of like I pitched an idea to him that really resonated with him. So it was kind of like, and we kind of basically decided, okay, we're in this together. And then we did 8 pages and we sent it out. We got a publisher. So for us there, it was like, okay, you know, he could believe in my story because together combined, we put something together and it got interest from people.
That's an important point that you just made, though, was let's say you don't have the money to pay with someone. Yeah. That person needs to get something out of it, right? Yeah. So that means that they need to be super passionate about it. They need to feel some ownership of it for sure. They need to feel like it's theirs, that they believe in it.
Yeah.
And that might mean trying a whole bunch of different people, right?
Absolutely. And beyond that, or picking the project tailored to the artist that to seeing what the artist can do, what they're passionate about, finding out what they want, what kind of story they want to tell. I think that's really key too. And the other thing is, you know, Chris and I own Lost Angels together. So 50-50 ownership. So it's not like now if I paid Chris from the start, he would be work for hire. I would own 100% of the property, but he would be well paid for his services. But I couldn't afford to do that. And so, you know, we go into this is our project together.
Gotcha.
And that ultimately is the way most of my projects have come together. So with the margins with Amanda, it was, you know, she was new to it and it was hard because it's a lot of work that she has to do. But, you know, Paul Montgomery and I co-wrote the story and she's the artist and she has the highest percentage of what she makes from the book. You know, and that's one thing that's always tough for me is I feel like the artist does a lot more hard work day by day. It takes them a lot longer. One way that Chris and I kind of even out is that I do the design. I do the lettering and I do the book design and packaging design. So I'm not just the writer. I'm also, you know, the designer. That helps me feel like it eases my guilt a little bit. And then the other thing that I want to point out, because I think I wanted to say this in that class the other day and I forgot to, is that because I've talked about this with another writer, is that, you know, it seems like that the artist has to do a lot more work and they probably do on a day-to-day basis, but slaving over a pitch to get just the right words down in a 1 or 2 page pitch, I can't tell you how many days I've spent working on a particular pitch, trying to get just the right thing down and getting sick of it and throwing it away, coming back to it, because that is really the first thing that someone's going to read. They're going to see the art. They may see the first 6 pages, but they also are going to be reading that pitch to see if it's something that they want to publish. And so I spend a lot of time on that. And, you know, I think Chris sees that or Amanda, whoever it is, sees that and they know, okay, this guy is passionate. He loves this thing and I see it coming through. I'm excited. He's gotten me excited by, you know, by creating a pitch that I want to draw. And that helps me, find people, and it helps me find publishers. So, you know, so with Amanda, I already had a publisher. I had pitched to Fanbase Press, Barbara and Bryant Dillon. I sat down with them and we were friends. We had known each other for a while through various conventions and stuff. And I had three ideas and I kind of did like the Hollywood pitch meeting, but it was the margins was the one that really resonated with them. And then we were able to go to Amanda and say, look, we've got it. We've got a publishing contract, but you know, we need an artist and you would co-own this with us if we do this. And so, you know, she agreed and, you know, we came on to get together. And then, you know, as things start picking up like that, then you can start. So then I had a gig writing a one-shot comic book based on a video game property. And that one, I knew the artist through the DC Talent Development Workshop, which I had been a part of as a writer. And I had met Priscilla Petrades, who's a Brazilian artist in New York when we had all been brought there by DC. And so we became friends, you know, at the bars and everything at the con chatting. And I'm like, we're going to work together. And so when an opportunity arose to do this like sci-fi book, and I knew that I could get her a page rate. Page rate being the dollars that the artist gets per page drawn, as opposed to like a creator owned deal of, you know, you get profits, but you own it once it's published. I knew that she liked me. She wanted to work with me. I liked her. I wanted to work with her. And then it was kind of like getting her on board with the editors, making sure that it was a good fit that way. And then knowing that I could pay her through them, not me directly, but I could get her paid. If you can get your artist paid, that's a big deal.
Yeah, and one of the important things you're mentioning is actually getting out there. You're going to cons, you're connecting with artists, you're meeting people. That it's very difficult to be a writer by yourself behind your computer, sending blind emails to people, hoping for collaborators. Right? It really does take meeting people face to face. And finding a personal connection.
Yeah, especially the comics industry. It's so small that like I feel like, even though I go to like a lot of different shows and I think I get frustrated at times when I feel like I haven't done enough or I didn't go out and I didn't, you know, make the right connections, but almost everything I have done has been through some kind of social interaction, usually in and around a convention of some kind, you know, like that's where you meet the editors and have a beer with the editors.
Yeah.
And I say this saying you can't be the you still have to be like a cool person, you know, like, like you can't just go in there and be like, you know, like I have a script to sell you, drink this beer with me and we will talk about the script. You'll love it. You know, like they're not going to respond to that, but you can make connections at these shows and people remember you later. They remember if they liked hanging out with you or if they liked talking with you. And then that can lead to, you know, a more fruitful conversation, let's say.
Yeah, it's like any kind of networking. It's like going on a first date, right? So you don't want to go on a first date and talk about yourself the whole time and pitch your projects. Actually get to know the person, talk about them, ask them questions, be cool, engage. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, there have been times where I've been able to send off a package to a publisher, you know, and get a response and everything, even though I don't know them at all. But I feel like, most people would say, especially in comics, that networking is a big part of it. And it's a small enough industry that, you know, going to shows can be a big part of that.
Right. And it's a small enough industry that if you are a jerk, it's going to pass around really quickly too, I think.
That's very true.
So we need to wrap up here, but I wanted to ask you about the DC Comics Talent Development Workshop that you were a part of. How did that come about? And I'd love to know what kind of lessons you learned of being a part of that.
That was such a cool thing. So it was the 2016 DC Talent Development Workshop. I was in the writer's side of it. And so that was their second workshop. They did three altogether. The first one, they went around and selected people. So they went out to people that they knew that were kind of up and comers.
Gotcha.
And the premise was that Scott Snyder, and I'm going to speak more to the writer's side because I didn't, you know, that's what I experienced. But the premise was that Scott Snyder is going to take these sort of up and comers, like not quite ready for prime time, and make them ready for prime time. Like basically, you're there, you're doing the work, but now let's look at how to make big, bombastic superhero comics perfect for DC, like what DC wants. So my class was the first class where they opened up submissions to anyone. And so I submitted Lost Angels and Sparrow and Crow, which was the very first comic book I did which was a prequel to The Wormwood, the audio drama. It spun right out of the audio drama because an artist approached us who loved Wormwood and was like, have you ever thought about making it a comic book? And we ended up working with him to do a prequel miniseries and got a publishing deal for that.
So cool.
Yeah. So again, Wormwood was key to a lot of this. And at the time, Scott was, I think he was actually, he knew the iFanboy guys pretty well, and he talked a lot with Paul Montgomery. So I had talked to him, but Paul sent him the first issue of Sparrow and Crow, and he gave us a quote, a pull quote for it.
Cool.
So when it came to, so this is like 2012, right? So when it came to 2016, yeah, I put in the Sparrow and Crow thing and the Lost Angels chapters, and I mentioned, oh yeah, and Scott wrote this about this book, you know. I don't know if that helped or not, but I mean, I know that he had talked to me previously after reading it, and he had said, you know, he had expressed an interest in my work and in doing stuff with me and stuff like that. So when it came around, that's what I submitted, and you know, and I got selected. I was completely just gobsmacked. You know, I saw all my other friend, a lot of other people I knew online that were getting rejections, and this is how insecure I am. I had not heard anything. I had seen other people getting rejections. I had not heard anything. And I assumed I had screwed up the application so badly that it didn't even go through. So I wouldn't even get a rejection. And so then I got this email like, you're invited. And and it was amazing. So it was Bobby Chase, Andrea Shea, and Sarah Miller. Yeah, yeah. And they were sort of like the talent development department at the time. I think they've sort of moved into different areas. Like I think Bobby and Sarah both handle a lot of the YA stuff that DC is doing now. And Andrea is doing, like she's an editor, full-on editor at this point. We basically get into like a Zoom call. Everyone knows what a Zoom call is now, so I can actually refer to it by name. But we would get in a Zoom call with all of them in Burbank, and then Scott in New York, and then, you know, like six or seven of us on this call, and we would talk about and Scott would take us through like a lesson plan he had developed about writing comics, not just writing comics, but really specifically writing superhero comics.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so that's why, I don't know how useful that is or isn't. I mean, it was definitely useful for me. And also I made some incredible friends through that I still talk to all the time, and collaborations that, you know, are spinning out of that and everything. I wrote some video games actually, because of the two of the women that were a writing partnership in the talent development workshop. They're game writers. At one point, Desiree brought me in to write for the 16 Candles game that NBC Universal was developing for the iPhone app. And I wrote on the first season of that. Yeah. So, I mean, like, there's me pivoting again now from comics into video games, which was an insane way to look at your writing, by the way, when you have to understand like a critical path that everyone has to follow and then all the branches, like writing a choose your own adventure. It's crazy. It will really help you with your writing. But yeah, with the talent development, Scott would talk about a lot of stuff. He would talk about like kind of taking drama and heightening it, kind of basically like turning it up to 11, how to work with voice of characters, plot structure. And really a lot of it was, you know, tailored toward, you know, making the best big superhero comics that you could make. And it was really fun. It was really fascinating. It ultimately didn't lead to much for me working with DC. I got to do a story in a new talent development showcase. But, you know, in the meantime, it's sort of, you know, you've got five or six new writers or writing teams, you know, and that have been trained by Scott. But editorial has their own stuff going on. They've got writers that they like working with. They've got plans that are being put into motion even as you're going through this workshop. And so a few of us got a few writing jobs out of that, but you know, it hasn't really led to a lot. And it's not any fault of the program itself. It just sometimes when you're, you know, working for a publisher or want to do something with a publisher and the publisher's plans are changing and you know, priorities are shifting, things don't always go the way you want to. But I learned a lot from it and made a lot of friends out of it. So, you know, it definitely is a worthwhile experience.
Yeah. So I just love the breadth of experience you've had in touching in different areas. And I know that's got to influence everything that you do. I'm curious, for someone specifically interested in writing comics, where do you suggest people start? whether they've written a little bit, they've never written anything. What's kind of step one for someone that wants to write comics?
Well, that's a really good question. Well, you mentioned Scott McCloud, so go and read Scott McCloud's book, because that just helps you understand the mechanics of it a bit. It's a little, it can be a little, he's very entertaining in the way he tells it, but it's very academic at the same time, right?
Yeah. Well, it's like a textbook, but it's a comic book.
Right? But it's really good at kind of getting you under thinking about the language of comics and what it can do. So I think that's a good start. And then find scripts to read, and they're out there. A lot of people will put their script online or their script books out there. I would stay away from something like an Alan Moore script. I mean, you can look at it as like a novelty, because he writes scripts that are super detailed. And most people, I think probably all writers working today, no one writes scripts like that. In fact, right. I would say it's much more lean. Like, I know that there are writers that I've talked to where if for a 20-page comic, they might have like a 12-page Word document that's their script. They're very lean in how they do the panel descriptions, and that may shift. Like mine, depending on formatting, sometimes for a 20-page comic, I've had like script formats using like Final Draft or something where my script would actually be like longer than the comic itself. Some of that is me overwriting. Some of that is me, my own insecurities, and like, or like, let's say we're building a world, you know, like when I'm starting off Lost Angels, I've got to describe a lot up front so that I don't have to describe it later, because we're building a new world. You know, it's not Portland, Oregon. Yeah, it's not New York City. It is a version of Los Angeles where there's a giant silver city full of angel aliens that sits where Santa Monica used to be. You know, and so I had to put a lot of thought into that, because, you know, I wanted to understand the world, you know, going back to what we said about kind of going into the details to kind of find the universal. I had to build in my own mind a lot of those details, and I wanted to pass along a lot of those details to Chris, even if, you know, he's going to throw all that out the window and draw what he wants to draw. You know, he at least knows what I was thinking. And so, you know, usually a good artist is going to find a way to do that. So, you know, find scripts and look at how people do them, and understand that there's no one way. It's not even as uniform as the film industry. It's a lot more. People use different software, different methods. But as long as you have that page one, panel one, caption one, you know, you're kind of off to the races. And then, yeah, just really find an artist that you can either pay or that you want to work with, and, you know, kind of really see if you can tailor your story to them so that, you know, you really get them on board and get them excited. And then for me, and this may not be for everybody, but I know a lot of novelists, they kind of write into the dark. You know, they don't know where they're going exactly. They just have an idea and they're sort of winging it. But for me, because I know I'm going to have to sell a pitch, I have to outline it. And so I will use different story structure tools I mentioned in the class, the Dan Harmon's Story Circle, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with, because that's, you know, very well known at this point. And I don't use it dogmatically. I sort of like refer back to it, like, okay, what needs to happen next? Where are we in the story? How dark do things have to get? How can I push myself? And I'll kind of just reference where I am, you know, in this flow of the story to kind of see. And then I'll kind of plot it out based on the issues, because I know that if I can break down a story into five issues, and if I can write like a short paragraph for each of those, that I can kind of then kind of coalesce that into a pitch that is like that perfect blurb that gets the voice and the tone and the atmosphere and makes you want to know what's going to happen. And so to me, that's really important to do that, because that's going to be the document that I take to the artist, that I take to the prospective publisher. You know, that's what I'm going to build my script off of. And so, you know, I like to work that way.
Yeah. And when something happens on which page seems so important in comics, as opposed to a screenplay where it's kind of fluid, right? I mean, you've got to get people turning to the next page. So the last panel has to be intriguing. You got to get people buying the next issue. So the last page has to be intriguing and all that kind of, it's a little more mathematical in that way.
It is. And that was hard to get used to, but you're absolutely right. And I can't emphasize that part of it enough. When you get down to the scripting stage, or even before that, when you start breaking down your story into issue chunks, you got to know, like, I like to start it this way. Like, okay, I know that issue one starts here and ends here. This is a great final image. And that's going to be the cliffhanger. People have to get issue two if they read to this point. And then, like you said, even from that, then you have Your page turns, which are another crucial thing, which is, look, the only way that you have to create tension and surprise is by getting the reader to turn the page. So your right-facing page, if you're thinking about holding a comic book or a graphic novel in your hands, the page on your right is the one that hides the rest of the pages. You know, we don't think about this in a novel because we got to read all the words, you know, but if you're looking at it and you put like the giant monster in the middle of a right facing page, well, the moment they turn to the left page, they're going to see that image already. So what you want to do is you want to lead them right down to the bottom of the page. And then you want to have that shot of somebody going, wait, what? And then they turn the page and then the monster jumps out of the closet at them. And maybe that's a splash page, a full page image, because now you've got the big glorious moment that you've built up to. And so the only way you know your page turns is if you know what is on the left page and what is on the right page. So I start with, here's the first image, here's the last image. And then I put down in a notebook, you know, like, left page, right page, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then I kind of figure out, okay, so this page, so I know I want to get to this reveal here. So I know that needs to be on page 5 so that when they turn to page 6, the big reveal happens. You know, that's a left facing page. That's where the reveal sits. And I have to your point, it's mathematical. I have to work it out that way. And that can sometimes be tough for writers, but I've kind of had to train myself to do it that way, just as a way of ensuring that, you know, when I get that first issue scripted, that I know that all the page turns happen in the right places, all the splash pages happen in the right places, that the cliffhanger comes at the right time and the right place in the story. And I know exactly where the second issue is going to pick up.
Very cool. Yeah, I think, comics are just so magical in that way. I'm a big believer in writing with constrictions, you know, putting constrictions on myself, because that increases creativity. And I think comics do that even more so when you have to start thinking about those things. I think it's just such a fascinating way of writing.
I'm with you. I think I'm fueled by restrictions. Sometimes I like a writing prompt or something like that to just get me going.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you tell me like you can't do something and then I'm going to be like, oh, I have a story idea that uses that. I'm very much the same. And I never thought about it that way, because there's another part of me that resists structure and rules, that thinks that that's like the bane of like the artist's life. Right. But the fact is, more often than not, I'm fueled by that. And I'm like, okay, I know if I can make this page land here, I'm going to be in a good place, you know? And so then it becomes exciting that way. Yeah. Yeah. So it is very interesting.
Great. So we wrap these up with the same 5 questions every time. Okay. So I will flow through these. So first is, what do you write?
Everything, as you can tell. I mean, I write stories. That's the best way I like to say it. I love comic books, but you know, I've got short stories and novels that I'm working on at the same time. And I think that I'm kind of story agnostic in terms of the medium. So for me, I write stories. I write stories with a lot of symbolism, but hopefully have a lot of truth in them.
What's your proudest accomplishment?
Oh, man. I feel like I have to say my son, who is 19 years old.
Oh, wow. No. Awesome.
I mean, that obviously, you know, that is my proudest accomplishment. But
especially if he's listening.
Yeah, especially if he's listening. But I mean, thinking just in terms of creativity, getting into the talent development workshop was such a huge thing. I was so proud of that. But I still got to say that I think Wormwood, creating Wormwood and how it created so many other opportunities for me, is still one of the most pure, zaniest, creative, wildest, most passionate things I've ever done. And we were working without rules. We were kind of making it up as we went. And I had a bunch of friends who just got to make, who were just ready to like get together and make stories, and nothing was too ridiculous. And that led to everything else I've written. So as much as I love Lost Angels and The Margins and every single comic book story I've written, you know, I guess in some way, I still think that like the Wormwood was like this huge turning point for me.
Yeah, no, I can totally relate and totally get that. So how do you define success?
Man, there are days where I think it's monetary, and then that means that I'm not successful yet, or I'm still pretty far down there. But for me, I'll tell you what, it is when I get that email where someone says, you know, I just discovered Wormwood, or
Wow.
Man, I read your comic and it really touched me. There's a few people that, you know, reading the margins really like just did it for them, like in terms of, because it is a story about creativity. It's a story about creating art in isolation and how it can both connect us and isolate us. And I knew that that was going to be heady and kind of maybe a writer's story. So when people came out and said, "Oh my God, I read this. This is amazing," you know, it just means so much to me. The fact that people still, somebody found out on Twitter that I was going to be at the Emerald City Comic Con last year. And they're like, I never met you in person, but I love Wormwood. And they came in and they were so excited. And I gave them a script from one of the early Wormwood episodes that was signed. And she was so happy about that. And it just like, I'm like, screw money. Like success is this. Success is knowing that you've connected with somebody. And I don't say that with like an ego, like, look at how awesome I am. I say it like this stuff, you know, from talking to me, this stuff means something to me. Like that. And in fact, I know we're in our end game here, but I wanted to, this anecdote that I didn't realize until years later, you know how we said early on that, like, I try to know what I'm writing about. It was my therapist, no surprise there, was the one that helped me realize this, that I, around 2007 or six, when I was writing Dr. Xander Crow, who was this failed psychologist who had become like a washed up exorcist because he had seen a young girl kill herself because she was possessed by a demon. And he was this arrogant guy who thought he had everything figured out in terms of the human mind. Right. And to me, that was like the scariest idea. So where your ideas come from, I always thought that like The Exorcist, which I love that film, but I thought scarier than like the priest who's struggling with his faith would be the atheist who thinks that there's nothing and then suddenly realizes that his whole world is turned upside down. And and so that's the genesis of that character. But it wasn't until many years later, and speaking with a therapist, that, and I was talking about Dr. Crow, and she said, "That's interesting that you wrote that a couple of years after your marriage broke up. You know, you had a marriage and a child, and then and a job, and then you lost a job, and then that created hardships that, you know, caused pressures on your relationship, and then everything sort of fell apart in a couple of years. And here you have this guy who's surviving this huge trauma and trying to figure out what it all means. He's trying to understand. He understood the world before. He is a psychologist who does not understand a world with demons in it. And now he has to figure that out." So it's so important for me when I write that stuff that kind of, especially now that I kind of have a better insight into that I know what I'm writing about or what it means to me. It's very personal to me in a lot of levels. And so when people resonate with that, you know.
Yeah, that's why I love that answer so much, is that art is so much about tapping into ourselves and getting stuff out and healing some of those demons. And it doesn't have to be so on the nose about it. It just happens naturally when we choose to be honest. So I totally get, and I really believe that art isn't about the artist. It's about connecting with the person viewing the art, with the person experiencing the art. Mm-hmm. That's why I love that answer so much, because when you are honest, and the more honest you are, the more people connect with it, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So what writers do you most look up to and why?
Oh man, good question. Let me think about it. I mean, so you know, they come from different time periods. I absolutely love Michael Chabon's Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, because he wrote this great literary fiction that also has the spirit of superheroes in it, you know, coming out of the golden age of comics and everything like that. And so he's a writer that I follow a lot. Neil Gaiman, I mentioned through Sandman. And that one, you know, I just love the way he talks about stories. And I find a lot of I relate a lot to that. In terms of people, I think right now in the current marketplace, Tom King as a writer with his books like Mr. Miracle and even Batman, I think he's just he knows what he's doing with his craft right now. He's somebody that's really at the top of his game in terms of a comic book storyteller and understanding.
He did the Vision book as well?
Yes, the Vision book for Marvel, Miracle for DC, a long run on Batman for DC. And I think if anybody were looking, you know, to see who he is, you know, that Vision book, Marvel's Vision, it was like a 12-issue series, fantastic piece of work. And then his book, Mr. Miracle, another 12-issue series. Well, he does these like long-form novels, essentially. I think he's at the top of his game in terms of the craft of comics.
Yeah, I had another. We did this best of decade list over on the Mirrorbox website. And one of the suggestions was that Mr. Miracle book was the best comic of the last decade. So I haven't read it yet, but apparently it's getting high praise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely worth checking out for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of screenwriters and stuff, too. But like, you know, like those are the ones that just jump to the top of my mind at the moment when you ask that question. Cool. So
that's great. Last question. What advice would you give to your younger self?
Oh, man. These are really good questions. I mean, as cheesy as it sounds, I mean, I honestly think that my younger self would be pretty impressed at where I've ended up, just because, again, if we're not defining it by like monetary value, the fact that I tell stories like this and that I have stories about like, you know, exorcists and winged people and, you know, writers and things like that. I think that kid who wrote that dragon story in the fourth grade would be pretty impressed.
So I think
in that sense, I think I'd want him to know, don't be embarrassed, because you're going to go through a period where you're going to be horribly embarrassed about your love of fantasy and genre and superheroes and comic books. You're going to go through a period, but you know what? You're going to hit 2008 and Iron Man's going to be in the movie theaters, and then everybody's going to be, going to be the nerd you are now.
That's so true.
And maybe I could have gotten further faster if I got in a time machine and was able to tell young me that, you know, like keep going, don't give up, you know. But I think at the same time, like, you know, you're going to do it your own way. And you're going to be all over the place because of that. So embrace it. Because I do like in talking to you about all this, I like saying, yeah, I did write this and write that. And I've written a bunch of different stuff. And there's part of me that sometimes goes, oh, if I'd stuck to one thing, maybe I would be further in one industry. But I'm like, yeah, but I got to write an audio drama for 3 seasons. I got to do comic books. I got to write short films and direct short films. You know, I got to do a little bit of everything. And I kind of love that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing, man. It's funny how much I feel like my own story was that way in high school, that I kind of put all the nerd stuff on hold and I played in a band and tried to be cool for a number of years. And then, well, I wasn't very successful with that either.
Me neither, you know.
Yeah. And then coming back to it years later and falling back in love with it and seeing the world around me fall in love with it. And now we get to write these kind of stories and that people are consuming and have these kind of conversations and really talk about, hey, this isn't just about cool dragon fights. This is really about exploring emotions and human beings. It's a really special time we're in right now.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think that the fact that people love genre and it's very widely accepted is really great for us, because, yeah, I mean, whatever reason that those dragons first appealed to me, you know, it really did something to me. And the fact that we can play with that now and tell all kinds of stories with all kinds of different emotional resonance, because we know what we're doing with those metaphors, it's a great time for writers.
Definitely. So where can we find out more about you? Where can we buy your books? Where can we keep up to know what's coming out next? All that kind of stuff.
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at DACCAMPO. That's DACCAMPO. That's also my Instagram handle. So, you know, I'm not a huge poster on Twitter lately, but, you know, I do try to, if I'm promoting something, it'll be there. I've got a website at davidacampo.com, but that's pretty static. It's just sort of my bio and stuff like that if people want more information. Most of my books, all of my books are in print digitally. And so the best place, if you're open to digital comics reading, is to go to comixology.com and just, you can search my name, search my last name, ACCAMPO, and you'll see all my books. They're all there. There's a few things in print. Lost Angels, Volume 1 is in print. You can find that through Comiker Press. That's C-O-M-I-C-K-E-R. Yeah, K-E-R. That's right. Yeah. Comikerpress.com. If you go there, there's a store. You can order it, or you can order it through Amazon. And The Margins is available at fanbasepress.com, or I believe through Amazon as well. So those two are in print. And I think those are the only two actually in print, because we do like some little one-shot horror comics, but we do those and we publish them ourselves for shows. And right now I'm not doing any shows in person, for obvious reasons. So those are kind of on hold right now, but almost everything right now can be found digitally, you know, so that's where people should go.
Cool, man. Well, this was an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Dave. Look forward to connecting with you in person again at some point in the future.
Yeah, hopefully, man. Hopefully when we're allowed to connect with people again.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much, dude.
All right, man. No problem. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Man, that was such a cool conversation. It reminded me of growing up when I used to be obsessed with things like Harry Potter and Star Wars, Pirates of the Caribbean. Anything that had fantasy elements had me completely hooked. David's story was perfect for someone like me, because likewise, I love to create in different mediums, and I've been told by others to just try to stick to one thing, but how can I when there's so many possibilities out there? It's inspiring to see what someone like David has done throughout his life, showing that you never have to compromise your passions for the constraints of any medium. Now it's your turn. If you're enjoying the podcast and you're ready to take that next step in your own screenwriting journey, be sure to check out scriptblast.com and our online community for conversations with like-minded screenwriters. Join today, free for a week, at members.scriptblast.com. Again, my name is Avery, so be sure to shoot me a message when you join. Also, if you'd like to reach out to Hudson personally, you can reach him at hudson@scriptblast.com. See you next time, and remember, keep writing.